ministries. Yes, and maybe Minister of Roads, Minister of Water, because when you build a mine, this is what we did in the Kukuzulu province. 23 mining houses created the Producers Forum, and in partnership with the local premier, and at that time, Thabo Mafumadi was the Ministry of Economic Development and Finance, and mining fell under him in Skukuni province, that's Limpopo, and we had the executive mayor, and the first Producers Forum, in partnership with the mayoral committee, they were then put into the kitty. What it is that they do, that the government will be planning in terms of town and house planning and all the integrated development programs of the municipality. And we, the mining industry, will all put our money together and we raise more than 10 billion. We build dams. We build a collective road that not just my mine or your mine will be using, but everybody's mine. So I'm saying the integrated approach is very necessary. We took the World Bank on a trip during that time, some 2007 and 2008, and they called it Africa's best kept secret. They let people come and have a look at this model, and we then tried to let it translate. The mining industry then went beyond Skukuni. We then created the social labor plan, integrated resources producers forum in partnership with the government and local government and provincial government and national government in Northwest and in Northern Cape. Now, it comes back again. It depends on the ministry, but also the board. And the board championed that because all the board leaders were there together in the main board and the subcommittees of the board make decisions. But when that board became sterile, I mean, you know, I'm not sure whether the board is functioning. I hear there is a board now. But I'm just saying, you know, all other things fell apart. Now, where are we going to be within the next years to come? We have a mining legislation that everybody is not too happy with. We are happy with the changes that government is trying to make because we come from nothing. Remember, I started saying when I started, I was told I don't belong. Now you see that there are attempts, meaningful attempts in the legislation to try and address certain aspects and most of the aspects of the mineral, of the mining industry. We find that it depends on whether you have a willing player. And unfortunately, you find a lot of historic producers, when their primary listing started becoming offshore, these historic South African companies, not all of them, but most of them, then start having offshore outlook and training centers close, and you know, and the head offices are now repositioned in other countries, and you know, and then your country becomes just you know, an area where production is taken, but what is being plowed back into the country, and we really need to bring the industry back to the kind of industry we inherited, that was an effective industry for those companies that were the owners, not effective for us that were not owning. Now that when, and not just owning, not effective also for the black people that were told you don't belong because the law says so. Now it's a rainbow nation, and the rainbow nation is very clear in terms of what the country should do. And we're appealing to all the stakeholders. We need to do this together. And we need responsible producers that are really going not to try and look at tricky ways to beat the act and to beat the charter. It's a pity we're not talking about the charter, because the stories that will come out in terms of different elements of the charter will leave you very unhappy. And I see next to me sits a future Minister of Mines here. That's very good, my darling. Yeah. And anyway, Madam Chair, thank you very much. I'm open for questions.
Thanks, you've managed your time very well. Any questions from the members of the committee? Honorable Zamini?
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. My greetings. Just one clarity seeking question on the issue of women, white women, linking it with the Chinese. Are you saying white women should get equal opportunities with black women, besides the fact that you are saying because legally they were not allowed to participate in mining, besides the fact that their fathers or their husbands might have benefited as compared to black women who never benefited at all, whether in terms of the father or the husband, they never benefited anything. Are you saying they should get equal opportunities as white women and black women? The issue, I fully agree with you that they are South Africans. I hear that, but you know, you just spoke about Rainbow Nation. This Rainbow Nation has got a history. So are you saying that they should get equal opportunities? That's my question, Chair.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Yeah, I think I want to welcome your presentation. You know why I'm saying it? Because I want to understand if we know, I'm not going to say what. I want to understand many of the other presenters who are saying that this bill is not going to stand a chance in court. Do you think we must refer it back? Or do you think there is so many, flaws into this bill that we won't make it to pass it? I just want to understand what are you thinking?
In terms of the white women, I'm happy that question came up. Yes, they were legally excluded, but yes, their husbands were included. And through that, they did benefit. We were being selective in terms of their participation. I would have loved to see a situation instead of a big mining house offshore listing, or any mining company wanting to list offshore to run away from being part of the obligation of this country or for any other reason. Rather, let them give it to their wives, so that they can continue having the primary listing, so it could have been implemented in a selective way. It doesn't have to be a blanket way, because they had rights via their spouses and they benefited. But in terms of those companies, look at now where we stand. A lot of our mining houses are gone. Maybe if the wife was the new owner, they'd still be here. In those circumstances, I was thinking one should have a look at that. And by so doing, when they're gone, you have a lot of transfer pricing, you have a lot of illicit outflow of capital, companies that go and list offshore, and they have offshore marketing companies in other countries and in the tax haven, where they don't, if I sell this, whether it's coke or gold or platinum, at $5,000 per ton offshore, I sell it to myself, to my marketing company, at $500. 500 rands then or dollars. Then I come to government, I say I can't pay tax. I go to the workers, I say I can't increase your salary. And then I go to the DMR, the BEE, I can't pay your dividends. And that's why we have ETOS. That's why we have service delivery protests. That's why we have all these problems. Because a lot of taxation money is not staying back home. So we need to be smart and look at where do we address the disparities that existed in a way that we benefit. Now, if they were to give, in those circumstances where permission was granted for the white women, then they would have to stay here and not do offshore listing. You know, that kind of thing. Obviously, it's not every company that can offshore list. There are very few that did it. But that's one of the things. And so I don't want to be misinterpreted and be told that Bridget Hadev is now saying white women never benefited. Okay, they did, but they were also legally excluded. And this should not really dampen what we have right now, because the Charter has and the Mining Act has now gone beyond that to try and address some of the problems that are quite ambiguous. Now, secondly, in terms of the Act, you want to know whether it should be returned. You know, let me tell you what happened. When we created the first MPRDA and the Charter. You know, we had a minister who literally stayed, nagged everybody, not nagged, but did the job to the extent that we would meet and we would interact, and we even went before the charter was put out for tender to a three-day workshop in the middle of nowhere to Mpumalanga, the leaders of the industry, to go and thresh it out. Now, this minister has done his consultation, and I know MPRDA, that the National Council of Provinces, have been going to provinces and consulting, but where there are areas that are still a little bit uncertain here and there, nothing stops us from then having the same exercise that we've done very well before, where we, as leaders of organization, organized labor, organized business, rural communities, the departments that are directly and indirectly involved in the charter, led by the Ministry of Mines, with the Ministry of Mines officials, just go into a bosparat like we did one day in the past and try and address these problems. This is what I'm saying. And in the end, you're going to have not many people being happy. I'm not very happy with the fact, one thing I missed out in Section 57 of the Act. The Act has amendment bill. It has actually excluded the rights of workers. Okay? The first bill made it very clear that the functions of the board excluded the rights of workers, the rights of workers. It says here that the functions of the Ministerial Advisory Board, the following clauses below were in Section 58 of the MPRDA have been excluded from the Middle and Petroleum Resources Development Bill in Section 56B of the Amendment Bill. Section 58.1A2, the transformation and downscaling of the mineral and mining industry, that has been excluded. Now, how do you have a board that cannot advise the minister on the transformation and downscaling of the minerals and mining industry? And then, what also has been deleted was Section 58.1A4, dispute resolution. The board had the right to advise the minister on dispute resolution, but that has been excluded. I don't understand, why would anyone want to do that? Section 58B must, in consultation with the Mining Qualifications Authority, ensure the promotion of human resource development in the minerals and mining industry. That all has to do with the rights of workers and the rights of rural communities and the rights of future sustainability of the mining industry. And we are saying, as SANDA, it's not fair to the labor, it's not fair to potential future workers, it's not even fair to us as mine workers, because if we have a dispute with our workers, where do we then go and advise the minister in terms of solving it? And, you know, those are the things that we're saying. It's very important that we relook at this board. Is the right way to let the minister decide, I'm not going to have a board, even though the Act says we must have a board, and then some other thing is created called Mihdet, and then, you know, the board then comes back with another minister, and other stakeholders don't sit there, others do sit there, you know, it becomes a problem. So, you know, we have to be, as much as I feel strongly about certain issues, I feel very strongly about the workers' rights.
Thank you very much. Finishes the debate on the SANDA presentation. Thank you very much, ma'am. Can we then go to the next one, Legal Resource Center? Thanks. Is it the presentation?
We've got two documents,
yes.
One of 80 pages that we're just going to tell you what it's about, and one of 6 pages where Advocate Bishop is going to talk about very, very briefly. And we're fortunate that we're going to be short with the 6 pages. My name is Henk Smith. I work for Legal Resources Center.
Okay.
And Vilmin Wickham and myself, Vilmin was handing out the documents there. We're responsible for the 100 pages to you because we've been writing to your committee and your predecessors over the past 2 years. So we're very glad that we can be here today to quickly tell you what we wrote to you about.
Okay.
With me is Victoria
Shea,
and then Michael Bishop. You will see on page 2 of our long document that we are here on behalf of our four clients, one of which is Kolobeni Umgungun Gluvu community. And Nonse Butuma says very sorry that she is not here today because she wanted to be here. And she wants to express this appreciation for your colleague, comrade Tony Duba, and advocate Kuleka Beja, who came to the Konkulu at Kolobeni and shared, had a hearing of your Eastern Cape province. And it was a very successful hearing because real meaningful engagement and learning happened on that occasion. People walked far to attend. Mm. 250 people were there. Community members were there, well prepared, and a lot of exchange happened and mutual learning. Unfortunately, our colleagues from the department arrived late because, of course, it's very, very far and the roads are very bad to get there. But this, it was a good occasion. But this, what we discussed was not the wording and the text of the bill. It was about the real issues for the community, and this bill does not address the real issues for the community and the reality on the ground. Neither does it address the expectations which of your province's portfolio committee on what it wishes for development for its communities in Pondoland and elsewhere. I'm just saying that in respect of that meeting. I don't know how it went in the other meeting in Eastern Cape, but our organization attended a number of hearings, and there were very uneven hearings in other provinces, and we've had reports of hearings that cannot count for that work. So that we want to say, at least on the 18th of April 2018 in Kolobeni, there was a good meeting, but not about this bill. I've got five sentences to say, and then Michael must talk, because he's got child-minding duties, and unfortunately he will leave, but because Wilmin and I wrote all the letters, we'll be able to answer your questions. One, how does Parliament promote the restructuring, the transformation of this industry, recognizing that the regulatory regime up to now, BEE, SLP, player referee conflation that we heard about from SAMDA and Mrs. Khadebe, and capital flight. How do we address this transition and conversion regime that we had for the past 15 years that did not work, that is failing us? And I'm saying this because the introduction for the charter of a week and a half ago admits that. The current regime has failed us. It has not lived up to the expectations. The charter says it in the introduction. The HLP, the Motlanthe, President Motlanthe high-level panel hearings in each of the provinces, it came up time and time again. We heard it even from SAMDA today. We are saying this. We need an overhaul. Thank you. Can we try this one?
We need an overhaul of the Act.
Honourable Chair, the Act must be overhauled. The Act must be renegotiated. It must be addressed the legacy. It must address the future. We cannot continue tinkering with a piece of legislation and with piecemeal, half-hearted charters that are in any event going to be delayed. We need legal certainty. How do we get legal certainty and transformation? The only shortcut, the only constitutional way to do it, is to reject this bill on procedure, to start afresh without any waste of time, where we redraft, we restructure, we renegotiate, we put communities at the center. That's what it's about. And we have a real socio-economic impact assessment. When Mr. Rudy Dix and his phalanx from the Department of DPME comes to help us to look at the economic, social, and other impacts of the challenge that we're trying to address with the transformation of an industry which has been long outstanding for 150 years. This flawed process, in terms of our constitution, provides an opportunity. And this opportunity is to give real effect to real equality under our constitution, real recognition of customary law under our constitution, and we're going to address you briefly on this opportunity that is created by our flawed process since 2013. Chair, but why are we here today? And this is why I quickly must now show you page 50 of our thick bundle. The page number is at the top of the right-hand side. Now, page 50 is the referral letter from the President. That is why we're here today. Otherwise, we wouldn't have been here. We are constricted by the referral of the President. And on page 51, it is about the procedure of Parliament. And it is that paragraph that is relevant and that Mr. Bishop is going to address in his 6 pages. Now, I must quickly just tell you what the other important pages are. On page 58, it shows where we wrote, and you don't have to page to it. We wrote to Mr. Freddie Adams, Honorable Freddie Adams, your predecessor, on the 19th of March 2014, where we said, please don't water down community in the bowl as it was at the time. On the 25th of March, a few days later, please have a proper hearing so that we don't have a situation that is referred back by the President. And then on page 65, sorry, maybe it's worth it to page to the paginated number 65, because there is a little column at the bottom of that which illustrates this, Comrade Chair. It illustrates this. 5 of the 9 provinces at the time brought negotiating mandates to your second, to your NCOP, saying retain Section 23(2) capital A and community participation under a ministerial discretion. 6 provinces, it varies, but a significant number of provinces agreed go slow. Unfortunately, we barged ahead with this legislation. Now it's been referred back, very constrained terms of what we can work on, and we've still not addressed the issues that were there in 2013, in 2014, and are still there. Page 5 to 15, and we're not going to take you through the detail of the substance, where we've got specific wording that if this bill is resubmitted to Parliament, we propose that those be brought in. And a number of co-organizations looked at it and we workshopped it a bit, but a real legitimate community participation process, page 5 to 50 to 15, we've got wording, text wording that says this is what should be in the bill. For example, section 5 capital A must provide that interim protection of informal land rights act, community and rights holders consent must form the basis, the starting point, before we start new mining. On the issue of reparation, we've got to be consistent that all communities have real reparation, not through a fund that is managed by the minister, as now proposed by the charter, because that fund will again be captured. We have the history of the D account. We have the history of a native and land trust. We cannot have those trusts running the monies of our community. David Ramohan of Papu, he explained it to us how the D account is happening. Unfortunately, the same thing is... How can it be that we're sitting with a draft, with a bill, that on page 7, line 18, wants to take communities out of participation and principles? We can't continue with this bill. It must be rejected and it must be restarted. So Michael is a veteran of a constitutional court case about where we argued the Lamosa case exactly on the procedural issue, and he wrote the definitive text. And Jeff Butlander joined him in that, but Michael also wrote a definitive text, which was apparently shown to you the other day in one of our constitutional, in one of our parliamentary rules handbooks. And Michael will now talk to the 6 pages, and we won't ever subject you again to our 81 pages. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you very much. It's good that you are still left with 15 minutes.
Thank you, Chair. I'll be very brief. My brief was only to look at the procedural flaws with the bill and whether, if it was challenged, if it was passed following this process, by the National Council of Provinces and then by the National Assembly for further amendments, and which was signed by the President, would it be upheld by the Constitutional Court? And my view is that it wouldn't. And there's 3 reasons why the Constitutional Court would say that the process that was followed was unconstitutional, leaving aside whatever the substance of the bill may be. So the first flaw is that the way that that Parliament, both the National Assembly and now the National Council of Provinces, has dealt with the President's procedural reservations. He had 2 substantive reservations and 2 procedural reservations. And Parliament has not followed its own rules in dealing with those. And because it hasn't followed its own rules, it's acted unconstitutionally. The second is that even with regard to the substantive amendments, it's gone far beyond what the President referred to this House, to the Parliament. And Parliament is not allowed to go beyond what the President referred to it. It's very clear in terms of Parliament's own rules that it can't go beyond what the President referred. And the third flaw relates to the public participation process that's been followed in the provinces. A lot of people have spoken about that already, and I'll only mention it briefly. So if I can start just to quickly lay out what the Constitution says and what the rules say about how Parliament needs to deal with this type of referral by the President. As the committee will know, as you'll know, Chair, it's dealt with in Section 79 of the Constitution. Section 79.1 says if the President has concerns, he can refer it back to Parliament. And then 79.2 is important, and it says the joint rules and orders must provide for the procedure for the reconsideration of a bill by the National Assembly and the participation of the National Council of Provinces in the process. So the Constitution doesn't specify exactly what process Parliament must follow once it's referred back by the President. It says, Parliament, it's up to you. You deal with it in your joint rules and orders. But that must mean that Parliament must follow what's in its joint rules and orders, that it can't go outside what's in its joint rules and orders when it's dealing with a referral. And it's important to stress, and the Constitutional Court has made this point in the case about the Mpumalanga Petitions Bill, that this isn't a ping-pong where it goes back and forth between the President and Parliament. Parliament says, oh, thank you for your reservations. We've now made some other changes. We're sending it back to you. The President says, thank you for those. I've now got some new reservations and your new changes. It goes back and forth. No, it comes back once from the President. And Parliament has one opportunity to reconsider it, and then it goes to the President, and he either signs it or he sends it to the Constitutional Court. And that's it. So if we then look, what has Parliament decided in its joint rules about how this should be dealt with? And the first point to make is that the joint rules are very clear for both the National Assembly and the National Council of Provinces that Parliament is confined to the reservations. So Rule 209.1 says the Chairperson refers the President's reservations and the bill to the committee. Rule 209.2a, the committee must consider and confine itself to the President's reservations. Rule 209.2c, the committee must report on the President's reservations and, if the Assembly has passed an amended bill, on the bill. Rule 210.2, the debate in the Council must be confined to the President's reservations. So it's not possible to consider anything outside the President's reservations on substance. So the 2 substantive amendments, that's it. That's all that the National Assembly could consider and that the NCOP can consider. And so the rules for the National Assembly are Rules 203 and 204. But the other important point about the rules is how they deal with substantive reservations compared to how they deal with procedural reservations. So for the NCOP, Rule 211 deals with procedural defects. and it makes no provision for amendments. So what's envisaged as a procedural defect is Parliament didn't get the necessary majority. There weren't actually enough votes. Or when they followed the mediation process after a difference, they didn't actually follow the correct process. Or something that should have gone to the NCOP didn't go to the NCOP. But what it envisages is the bill as it was, without amendments, can be corrected because that procedural process, that procedural flaw can be done on exactly the same bill as it was. And that's how Parliament has regulated its own business, how it's decided in its rules that if it's a procedural reservation, there will not be a possibility for amendments. And it makes sense because otherwise you're going to get into this ping-pong situation where there's a procedural reservation and then we reconsider the entire bill, new amendments, new public participation, a new bill emerges and it gets sent to the President. And he says, but I have new reservations about these new sections you've added. But he has no opportunity to refer it back to Parliament because he's had his one shot. And that's why Parliament, wisely, doesn't allow amendments based on procedural reservations. And it's very clear if you look at Rule 212 that there are amendments permitted for substantive defects. And there's a very detailed process for how those amendments will be considered and how they can be made. And when you compare the procedural with substantive, it's clear you cannot have amendments following from procedural defects. So if we then look at the... and then Rule 208 says that if the bill is so procedurally or substantively defective that it cannot be corrected, Parliament should reject it, but it can introduce a new bill of substantially the same content. And that's what Henk was saying, that Parliament should do in this instance. And it's not this committee's fault that the procedure up to here, that we've got to this point, but this committee has to decide what to recommend to the NCOP to do now that we are here. And we say Rule 208, it's too much of a risk if you pass it at this point. That'll be set aside later. Follow Rule 208, say that this is too defective, and start again with a bill that's substantially the same. So if we then look at the three flaws briefly, the first has been mentioned already, that the amendments that have been made, both the 8 amendments in the National Assembly, the 57 amendments proposed by the Department, go far outside the reservations made by the President. And that's unlawful, that's unconstitutional. And if it's passed in that form, it will go to the Constitutional Court. The court will say the correct process wasn't followed and will declare the entire bill invalid. And all that would have happened is another 2 years would have been spent in court and millions of rands on advocates' fees. Yeah. So if we then talk about the second flaw, and this I think is perhaps one that seems technical, but it's very important. The procedural reservation that the President made was that there wasn't adequate public participation in the NCOP in the provinces. So he says, go back. But the only way you can have proper public participation is if there can be amendments. Public participation is not meaningful if we can't, the people who are participating can't convince the provincial legislature that they should try and amend the bill. Otherwise, there's no point. It's a farce. We're just going through the motions. But Parliament doesn't allow for amendments following procedural reservations. It's not in the rules. And so there's this catch-22 where it's impossible for Parliament to remedy the procedure, the procedural defect. But Parliament provided for that in Rule 208 and says then what you do, you stop and start again. And that's the option that this committee should adopt. But the final flaw is one that's been spoken about by several speakers today around public participation, and whether this new process that has been followed in the provinces was adequate. And it's obviously that this committee doesn't have control over everything that goes on in the provinces. But if what happens in the provinces doesn't comply with their constitutional obligations under Section 118, then the bill itself will also be unconstitutional, even if this committee has complied with its obligations. Because when a bill is passed by the NCOP under Section 76, both the NCOP and the provincial legislatures have to meaningfully facilitate public participation. And if the provinces don't do that, the bill will be invalid even if the NCOP does. So I don't have clear instructions about all the provinces and what happened, but I've heard enough today to be very concerned about whether or not, based on the Lamorsa decision, whether this bill would pass muster. The same sort of concerns about the bill not being provided in time, not enough notice being given, not enough time to prepare, no translations of the bill being provided. or why the court set aside the Restitution Rights Amendment Act in Lamosa. As Mr. Butler pointed out, he argued it. I didn't argue it, but the result is the same. So just to conclude then, the process that's been followed has been fatally flawed for these three reasons, and it cannot be fixed at this stage. So the best option is to reject the bill and start again. The other options for this committee are, if it does reject the bill and the NCOP in plenary then also rejects the bill that was passed by the NA, then it would go through to a mediation committee, and then the whole normal mediation committee process would follow. There's also a possibility under Rule 211(2) to refer the problem to the Joint Rules Committee for a ruling. If this committee takes a view that there's a real procedural problem here, it can refer it to the Joint Rules Committee to get its opinion about what should happen. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Comment? Please don't debate, because I know the presentation is tempting. Over to you, Honorable Mukwili.
So, thank you, Chair. The presentation is tempting to for us to debate and to criticize ourselves and analyze, and I don't know, just to check. I don't know, I've never been to your committee before. This is the first time I've been into your committee. I don't know whether legally have you got the, as a committee, the advice, because I think, in my opinion, that the advice that the Legal Resource Center is giving should have been given to the committee before even we engage further into the matter, and the supplementary documents to effect. Now I'm like, I don't know. That's why I say it's tempting to engage further.
No.
But thanks, Chair. I know you are very strict. In our committee, we sometimes divert when issues are raised like this, to just to be.
No, thank you very much. I've said it's really tempting for everyone, even including myself, but really we have to be in order. Just on your issue of e-advice, rest assured we do have an advice, but we're still in a process of having public participation. Let me assure you. Over to you, ma'am.
No, thank you very much, Chair. Also welcome the presentation, and do say that it is tempting, but just one clarity second question.
Can you give her a chance to speak? There's a lot of bars, remember.
Yeah. Just one clarity second question. I don't know, you might have said it, but I just want to be clear for my clarity.
Okay.
You are saying this process should limit itself to the president's reservation, which is procedural. Anything else is out. Am I hearing it right? And I do hear your recommendations, what you are saying. Is that a correct understanding?
Thank you very much, Honorable. Over to you, say.
Thank you, Chair. Not quite. So the argument is that the nature of the reservation that the President has made, that there wasn't adequate public participation in the NCOP, given the way that Parliament has structured its rules, the only option at that point is to stop and start again. Because the only way to fix it is to have a new public participation process. And that will only be a lawful process if it's possible for amendments to come from the process. But the rules say there can't be any amendments if it's a procedural reservation. And what the rules say, when it's so procedurally defective that it can't be fixed, is that you don't pass the bill and you start again with one that's very similar. So that's, and as I said, you know, the committee has been put in this position by the president, and the fact that the NA took this position. If I can, the first clarification that was sought, these same arguments were put to the committee in the NA as well. They didn't agree with it.
Thank you very much. Do you want to end? You've got yours.
Chair, it's on the 2 minutes on the opportunity of the recognition of proximity law. We announced it at the beginning that we wanted 2 minutes. The importance of recognizing the proximity law right to the NPRDA.
Fine, if you did submit on that when the legislature was there, I'm sure it's part of their report which have been submitted to us. You just covered. Now we are finished with the presentation of the Legal Resource Center. My colleagues, what is important about the last presenter's presentation is that it's an area that was no-go area in Eastern Cape at some point because of the same issues of mineral resources. It was a good thing that legislature decided to go to Kolobeni so that to begin to engage that community and be part of what is happening. Maybe you didn't know. Can I then give the other one, offshore? Opasa. Are they in now?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Honourable Members. Thank you for allowing us the time to present today. I know you've had a long day. We'll try and not make it any longer and try and be as fast as we can. I'd like to introduce my colleague. This is Maseko Siani. With us today we have Senior Counsel Advocate Jeff Budlinger to support. My name is Sean Lunn. I'm the Chairman of the Offshore Petroleum Association. We are the three in the MPRDA. The Offshore Petroleum of South Africa is, we represent companies that are exploring for oil and gas offshore. We have 15 members, including some of the world's largest international oil companies, as well as local black empowerment companies. Our aim is to explore offshore and take the large financial risks that are inherent when drilling deep offshore exploration wells. And if any of us are successful, our country, South Africa, will be the biggest beneficiary because new industries can be created and a new potential pillar for economic development for South Africa and its people can be created. But that's only if we find something. And by finding something, we have to take some risks. And the risks that I refer to are geological and geophysical. That's our business. That's what we do. We take risk in relation to below ground where we will spend the money to find out what is there. Where we have no appetite for risk is what we call above ground risk, which is legislative uncertainty and fiscal uncertainty, because when you combine them with the geological uncertainty under the ground, the risk is simply too high for anybody to invest. We started our journey on the MPRDA when my twin boys were 3 months old. This morning I dropped them off at school in their full school uniform, and they just recently had their fifth birthday. Mm-hmm. So that's how long we have been at this process. It's been a long and patient journey, but thanks to Ocean's Economy Operation Pekisa, we started to find each other and started to find common ground. I wanted to hand over to Operation Pekisa to my colleague Maseko to just finish off on Pekisa.
Thank you, Chairperson. As John had mentioned earlier, my name is Maseko Siani, and we started with mentioning that Operation Pekisa was one of the key processes that we undertook as OPASA. And you would remember that this was a process that was led by the Department of Environmental Affairs in partnership with the DPME, the NPC, various government departments, and the Malaysian monitoring and performance lab unit. That said, the whole objective of Operation Pagisa was largely to look at the hindrances that make it difficult for the ocean's economy to progress to levels that it achieves the initiatives of the NDP. And part of that process included deep conversations that were never easy, and I'll be the first to admit that the process was tough. Nobody got what they wanted. No one was 100% happy. And to put it lightly, we were comfortably unhappy when we all departed. But the process did what it was supposed to do, and part of it was put together outcomes that led to skills development programs and local content initiatives that would bring together the whole oceans economy debate, mindful of the fact that we were focusing on the MPRDA petroleum element of the conversations that were happening. In Operation Pagisa, we, like I said, we had long conversations over periods of time. But what was important for us as OPASA was that we landed on a win-win solution, which we called it a uniquely South African win-win a solution. And for us, that was the biggest take, because it represented a conversation that was frank, that represented both elements of the good, the bad, and what could work. And we landed on purely what could work for South Africa incorporated. And that said, I think we're well on our way to a process that will help us get to the bottom of the MPRDA, leading to what actually works for the country. Thank you. Thanks, John.
Thank you, Ms. Echo. I mean, the MPRDA for the petroleum industry is make or break for our nascent industry. We've been on the journey for 5 years to establish legislative certainty, and as OPASA, we attended virtually all provincial briefings across the country, and then the separate public hearings. I attended most of them personally myself. I got to travel across our beautiful country and see all 9 provinces, we personally submitted our petroleum-related amendments in every province. As the MPRDA and this process, and particularly the procedure, is so critical for our industry in a make-or-break state, when there was criticism aired over the process that Parliament has followed to date, we sought senior counsel opinion to establish their view on the proceedings to date, and we wish to answer some of the questions that I've just heard being raised just before I began speaking. Please allow me to hand over to Senior Counsel Jeff Budlinger so he can share his findings with the committee.
Good afternoon. Good evening, Chairperson and members of the committee. It's very late. I'm sure everyone's very tired, but let me try to summarize. I've been asked to address what are the powers and the functions of the NCOP at this stage as you come to the end of your process. I assume that the reason that I'm asked is that because I was the person who argued the Lemosa case, which resulted in a decision by the Constitutional Court that at that time the public participation process was invalid or inadequate. So what is the function of the NCOP now? Well, we start with Section 79(3) of the Constitution. And what Section 79(3) of the Constitution says is that the National Council of Provinces must participate in the reconsideration of a bill that the President has referred back to the Assembly if the President's reservations about the constitutionality of the bill relates to a procedural matter that involves the Council. That's what we're dealing with here. There's a procedural matter that relates to the Council. That's why you are now faced with the problem. But what it can only mean, what it then says what Section 79(4) of the Constitution says is, if after reconsideration, that's if after the NCOP has done its business, a bill fully accommodates the President's reservations, the President must assent to it and sign it, and if not, he must send it back to the Constitutional Court for a decision. So what it contemplates is that there will be a defect, there will be some which are procedural defects, and the procedural defects are dealt with here, and if the President is satisfied that they've been remedied, then he signs the bill and the job is done. So the NCOP is given the power to remedy the defects. We know that if it is a substantive defect, If the problem is the validity of a particular section, then the Parliament can only consider that. It can't consider other sections. The question is, what must Parliament do to remedy the defect when it's a procedural problem? Now, whereas a procedural problem, you have to go to Rule 2093A. Mr. Bishop referred to the rules, but he didn't refer to Rule 2093A. What Rule 2093A says is that if the committee agrees with the President's reservations, the committee must recommend how any procedural defect in the Council's proceedings can be corrected if the reservations relate to a procedural matter. And 211 deals with procedural defects, and it says a remitted bill which is procedurally defective must be returned to the President if the Council agrees with the reservations and corrects the procedural defect. So the whole structure of the Constitution and the rules is that where you've got a procedural defect, it will be considered by the NCFP, and the NCFP will try to fix the defect. It doesn't say, as my friends from the LRC say, if it's a procedural defect, you suck and you start all over again. The whole concept is you try to fix it. I should say I take some of the blame for what the LRC said. I was one of the founders of the LRC, but that was when I was a young man. I'm just teasing. I'm a great admirer of the LRC, but they're wrong in this respect. So the whole structure of the Constitution and the structure of the rules is that where there's a procedural problem, the NCFP will try to fix it and then send it back. The notion is remedy, not paralysis. This is not the Constitution doesn't say when there's a procedural defect, there's paralysis. It says you'd remedy. So then how is it going, what must the NCFP do to remedy the defect? And that's what you have to decide. The first thing it must do is it must facilitate reasonable public participation. And you've got to decide whether the public participation which has been held in the provinces is adequate. I've read the reports on what's happened. It seems to me that it was adequate. It wasn't perfect, but life is never perfect. The Constitution doesn't require that every step must be perfect and there can be no defects. What it says is that the process must be reasonable. And reasonableness means sometimes it's not absolutely perfect, but it meets the test, it's good enough. And it seems to me that it is good enough. Process, it seems to me, was reasonable. But certainly, I can tell you this, having been involved in the Lemosa case and having argued in Lemosa that the procedure there was inadequate, this was streets ahead of what happened in the Lemosa case. It's on a different territory altogether. The Lemosa case, it was sadly a rather miserable failure. Nobody could really say it was reasonable. Here it seems to me it was. But anyway, that's the first thing you must decide, is whether you think there's been reasonable participation. And then if you're satisfied with that, then you've got to consider whatever came out of that process. You can't go to the public and say, we are consulting you, but if you say you don't like this, you want something else, oh no, we will ignore that because we're not allowed to approve that. We consult you, but you're only allowed to agree. That's not what our democracy contemplates. Our democracy contemplates that when you have participation is not a sham, it's real participation, and if people put up good arguments, then you say, fine. And so obviously you can't be... The public participation can't be limited to the substantive problems which the President has, because then there isn't public participation. If there are 100 clauses of the bill and the President says there's only one to which I have a substantive obligation, objection, but I don't like the process. You can't say, oh, we'll only allow the public to participate on one section of the 100. You're entitled to look at the whole bill and to see whether you're satisfied with it and in the light of the proposals made by the members of the public. And so, with due respect to what is said by the LRC, what they propose is really two things. They propose, A, that...
Can I raise an order here? When we started the process, I made it clear that the presenters will not be discussing the presentation of another.
Right.
That would be very unfair. You present your case without referring to anyone who was presenting here.
Thank you very much. I'll follow that. Thank you for that advice. So the Constitution does not propose paralysis. It proposes remedy. And secondly, it does not propose sham participation. It proposes real public participation, in which the public can actually have a say, and Parliament will listen to them and act on what they say once Parliament has decided what is right. And so we submit that's really plain and simple what the position is. There's no need to make it more complicated than that. It's all fundamental principles. There's only one question, and it's addressed in the in the opinion which I was a party, which I think is going to be distributed or has been distributed, it's quite clear that whatever the public produces, the NCOP may consider and may deal with, may decide it's right or wrong. And what you've got before you is the recommendations which came out of Operation Pakisa, that is joint recommendations of the public and the department that you're entitled to take, entitled to look at it, and you're entitled to say we agree or we don't agree and to act on it. The only question is a marginal question is, are you also entitled to look at something which only the department produced? If the department on its own produced something, can you look at that into the public participation process? Can you look at that? And that's a matter which one can debate uphill and down, Dale, and I think it depends on a question of degree. For example, if a member of a community, a member of the public, says, I propose X, the department surely is entitled to say, this is the problem with X, but if you can address the problem by instead of doing X, you can do Y. That's what the department is required and expected to do. That's how public participation works. When I was in government in the Department of Land Affairs, that's what we had to do all the time. We have to listen and say, yes, we hear your problem, but we think your solution won't solve, but here's a better solution, we think. And then we would debate it and we'd propose it to Parliament. So certainly Parliament is entitled to consider amendments which come from the department, which are a comment on what has come from the public, and an attempt to deal with the question from the public. The only question is a very marginal set of amendments where nobody spoke about it, and the department just popped that out of its own accord and said, this is what we propose. And we don't know yet what the Constitutional Court would say about that. Anybody who tells you that he or she is certain about what the Constitution says about it is overconfident. The truth is we don't know, because this issue has never come before the court about whether a department itself can produce amendments in the public participation process. And so you'll have to make a choice, I suggest. And I suggest that the choice you have to make is two. You've got two options. Either you can say we will consider both the Pakisa amendments and the department's amendments, or we will consider only the Pakisa amendments. But the one thing I respectfully suggest you won't do is throw out the Pakisa amendments because you aren't considering the department's amendments. You can certainly consider and deal with the Pakisa amendments. They are the result of a process which is a model for our democracy, of all the role players getting together and working out how to do something in the interest of the country. And that is what public participation is about. Public participation, with respect, isn't just about somebody standing up in a meeting and shouting the odds. It's also about people sitting together in a room and debating and trying to reach agreement. That's when our democracy works best. So you can certainly adopt all of the Pakisa amendments. I suspect you can also adopt all of the departmental amendments, but certainly at the very least the Pakisa amendments, you shouldn't throw out that baby with the bathwater of the departmental amendments. And so that is what the law is. As I say, Parliament has given you a task. It's not an easy task. But the one thing you can't, with respect, do and won't do is fold your arms and say, oh, well, it's just bad luck. Now we start all over again. Let's have another 5 years of this. That's not what our Constitution requires, and that's not what the Constitutional Court will require. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much. You are spot on in terms of your time. I will allow members for 5 minutes to ask questions next slide. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you very much for the presentation. I just wanted to ask one question. It was very clear on the interpretation from your senior counsel on the paralysis versus the remedy. In the normal way of making legislation, the department in this instance came and make some new proposals as the beginning, as the starting point of the NCOP. I understand what you said is that Pakisa consulted together and the process is their recommendations coming through a public participation process. So the reason why I need clarity on this is if this committee in the process of trying to remedy is get to a point that some of the amendments proposed by the department are not, we find that it's not been proposed by any organization through the public participation process. Thank you.
Over to you, sir.
Thank you, Chair. That is the hardest question. It seems to me the answer is it's a question of degree. If, for example, the department proposed a provision, an amendment to the bill, which was a fundamentally new principle, it's never been to the end, never been considered by the National Assembly, never been considered in a proper public participation process. If it's a fundamental change of principle, then I suspect the courts would say you can't do that, because this is a process of public participation. But if, on the other hand, it is adjustments arising out of debates which have been going on over time, then it seems to me it is permissible. So I think the test you have to ask yourself is this an amendment of fundamental principle, or is it an amendment which is just part of the process of improvement of the bill? I can't give you a more precise answer on that, I'm afraid.
Yes, it really answered the question. Thank you very much for the presentation. Now we'll allow the last one.
Okay, ma'am. All right. Thanks. Thanks, sir, for workshopping us again. But I know you said it's for the committee and for the NCOP to decide whether they see this as a procedural. I don't remember the legal word that you used, but in terms of legality of the bill, it's for the NCOP to decide. In your view, as a legal law expert, what is it that you can advise the NCOP and the committee to do, in your view, as a legal person? Thank you very much.
That's not a question of clarity, that one. Definitely. Let's leave his views. Because he was saying to us, it's up to the NCOP if they feel strongly that they have complied with the procedural defects that were highlighted by the Office of the President. Other than that, it's up to us, not to him. Can we close it at that and allow the next speaker, Land and Accountable Research Center? Yes, outside the meeting. Oda, you two, niyaqala kukwenza izinto zenu. Oda. It's another very interesting presentation that we got. It can be really tempting to engage on it, which would not help this type of a meeting. We have our own time. Thanks for workshopping us, as she has said. Over to you, sir.
Thanks, Chair. And good evening to everyone. My name is Members also. I'm not sure if I should not say good night, Chair, because I know it's pretty late.
Good night.
With that in mind, Chair, I will be as brief as possible.
Is it okay for you? So that you can see the presentation from the slide.
Conrad, is that fine? Yeah, no, I'll be as brief as possible.
Okay.
So I think just due to Mr. Bauer's technical glitches of his email, the presentation was sent, but he didn't receive it.
Okay.
Hence, we're projecting over here. Like I said, I know it's late, so I'll be as brief as possible. Just a bit of background in terms of LARC and who we are. We are a research and advocacy unit based in the Public Law Department at the Law Faculty of the University of Cape Town. And we are concerned with the power relations and the impact of national laws and policy in framing the balance of power within which rural people struggle to assert and protect their rights. In particular, our mining research team looks at the impact of mining on communities in former apartheid homelands. And as you said, Chair, we're not supposed to talk about other people's presentations, but we do align ourselves with the presentation of the LRC together with and also those you know, that are of the opinion that the bill that the amendments added after the bill was referred back to Parliament cannot be considered under the rules of Parliament. Mm-hmm. The long and short of our submission is that the current bill must be rejected for procedural and substantive reasons, and that a fresh amendment process should be initiated. The procedural flaws. The bill and the 57 amendments must be rejected because the joint rules of Parliament provide that no amendments can be made when a bill is returned to Parliament by the President on the procedural ground of lack of participation. And the NCOP and the provincial legislatures cannot cure the flawed process of March 2014 by now holding fresh hearings, because these belated hearings cannot make amendments with shortcomings would render the hearings meaningless. I think everything here has been mentioned already. You know, the fact that the 57 amendments cannot be entertained, and that ultimately there needs to be the bill ultimately needs to be rejected in its 15D, that is, needs to be rejected in its entirety. So the substantive flaws. So as we, you know, based on what we've said in terms of procedural flaws, we're saying that, you know, and also the extensive research that we conduct in various mine hosting communities, that the bill should be rejected in its entirety because it fails to adequately address the concerns voiced by mining affected communities and people under the rules of Parliament. And what follows now are the substantive proposals, which are based on the assumption that there will be a fresh amendment process as required by the rules of Parliament. The focus for us here is on the proposals of a substantive nature made over the years by various stakeholders and organizations that are continually overlooked and ignored in the mining legislative and regulatory framework without reason or entirely reasonable basis. So firstly, taking it, you know, from the Constitution and what should form part of the MPRDA constitutional framework is that Section 25(6) of the Constitution provides that a person or community whose tenure of land is legally insecure as a result of past racially discriminatory laws or practices is entitled to the extent provided by an Act of Parliament either to tenure which is legally secure or to comparable redress. And then Section 25(9) further goes on to say that Parliament must enact the legislation referred to in subsection 6. 20 years down the line, all that we have in you know, all that Parliament's been able to produce in terms of answering 25(6) is what is called the Interim Protection of Informal Land Rights Act, and that was introduced to give partial effect to the right of tenure security for those whose tenure is insecure as a result of past racial discrimination. IPIORA provides that no one may be deprived of an informal right to land without their consent, except by expropriation. To save time, I won't read the actual provision of IPIORA. I'll just that's the just the important thing is that you know, people may not be deprived of an informal right to land without their consent. So customary and statutory rights with informal homelands qualify as informal rights. Informal rights to land include rights of occupation, use, and access to common property resources. So if the MPRDA is subject to the Constitution, including Section 25(6), to statute laws such as IPIORA and to customary law, despite this, mining licenses are routinely issued without the consent of those whose informal rights are at issue and affected. The way in which the MPRDA is currently implemented is therefore unlawful both in terms of statute law and customary law, which requires consultation, and in breach of the Constitution. This is particularly serious given that those whose rights are abrogated as amongst the poorest and the most legally vulnerable South Africans. So the constitutional vulnerability of the of the MPRDA is because acts of parliament should be interpreted to give effect to the constitution. The track record of the implementation of the MPRDA indicates that informal land rights and the consultation requirements of customary law are routinely ignored. Given this track record, it is imperative that the Act be amended to make explicit that both MPRDA consent requirements and customary law consultation requirements apply, and that mining rights cannot be issued unless there is clear evidence that these requirements have been complied with. So proposals in terms of content for a new amendment bill, and once again, Chair, this is based on the assumption that the process will start afresh. So it's not direct responses to the bill in its current form. It's the basis is moving from the MPRDA to a new amendment bill process. What we would like to submit is that these amendments must entrench the relevant requirements of the Interim Protection of Informal Land Rights Act as a precondition for the approval of any mining-related operations on communal land, or otherwise entrench the requirement of free, prior, and informed consent before mining. The MPRDA must be amended to give communities equal status to corporations in the negotiation of compensation for the effects of mining. This can only be done if they have a right to say no to mining. In terms of the third one is the MPRDA must be amended to establish a clear entitlement to compensation for communities affected by mining, and it should reflect international best practices. And I think through you, Chair, personally, I think that, you know, given our history and the current state of the nation, that Section 54, which deals with the compensation, must be amended to provide even more robust provisions than the international best practice regarding compensation for the loss of community land. The MPRDA must be amended to ensure that communities are consulted directly in a fair and transparent manner on all decisions affecting land that they own or occupy. The MPRDA must be amended to expressly ensure that traditional leaders and councils cannot be assumed to speak for or on behalf of people without verifiable evidence of consent under EPURA, where it applies, under the provisions of all related legislation, including the environmental laws and in terms of living customary law of the community concerned. The MPRDA must be amended to ensure that both revenues due to communities from mining-related activities on or near their land and opportunities generated by such mining activities are shared in an equitable and transparent manner amongst all members of the communities concerned. The MPRDA must be amended to provide that communities are entitled to free rider sharing in any entity entitled to mine on the community land. These revenues and opportunities must be shared in line with the collective wishes of the community members. And lastly, the MPRDA must be amended to create easily enforceable obligations on companies, the government, and local authorities, including traditional leaders and councils, to account proactively, transparently, and fully to ordinary members of the communities for all benefits, whether in the form of revenues, services, or opportunities generated by mining on their land. Chair, I will leave it at that. And I think that I was, you know, as quick as possible. So I take it then that might mean I don't have to answer any questions.
Thank you very much for your presentation. I hope you have covered everything that we've prepared, because for us it's important to get as much information as possible. Can I then allow the members of the committee to ask second question? Yes, ma'am? Honorable Lapskarten? Is it your own?
Mm-mm.
Okay,
yes,
sorry.
Thank you very much. I would like to know, you referred to compensation to communities and also based on international practices. Although your presentation was not you know, divided into sections and amendments and so on, I would like to know, do you have a model for compensation to communities based on international best practices? And the reason, Chairperson, for me to ask this is if this committee has to consider anything like that and amendments, that will take us another few months to do the research to find a best practice model to be included into the bill. Thank you.
Honourable, thank you very much, Honourable Chair. Just two issues. The first one is that I'm taking from my understanding that the constitution of the country is a supreme law. Which one supersedes what? Do they mean that it also goes to the other presentation? Do they mean that the parliamentary rules supersedes the constitution? I'm taking from what was said by other presentations as well. Do they mean that because they emphasize that because of parliamentary rules? Do they mean that the parliamentary rules supersede the constitution? That's one issue. The second matter is that why present recommendations now? Because according to them, they do it with the impression that they will start afresh. Why present recommendations now? If this one is a flaw, we're going to start afresh, it means that there will be an opportunity for them to come present. Why present now?
Okay. Why recommendation? I'm sure that's the question.
Thank you, Chair. In terms of the first question, in terms of the international best practice, so while the section provides for, so we'll be dealing with Section 54 now of the MPRDA, and while the section provides for compensation for any loss or damage, the standard of compensation is unclear, which is the problem. International instruments such as the International Finance Corporations, which is a member of the World Bank Group Performance Standard on Land Acquisition and Involuntary Resettlement, provide substantive guidelines on how compensation should be administered. So the framework is there, and you'll find that is, we did put that in our written submission. So, and it's paragraph 19 in that submission. So what we are saying there is that the MPRDA should be amended, you know, we believe it should be even more robust, you know, just given this country's history and, you know, the current situation where we're hoping, you know, to get to. That, I think it's one of the areas where, I mean, there's absolutely no reason why we can't be that international standard. In terms of the parliamentary rules don't supersede the Constitution, I think that parliamentary rules do not supersede the Constitution because nothing does. But I don't think that's what we are saying at all. I think, so firstly, we take it from the beginning. I mean, the thing is that the general understanding that the parliamentary rules are in line with the Constitution, starting at the top. And from that, we are saying that Parliament's functions and powers are, so Parliament's mandate and how it carries out its functions is done according to to parliamentary rules. So Parliament cannot act outside of its own rules, is the essence of what is being said about that point. And it's not speaking to the Constitution versus parliamentary rules. I think maybe to apologize if that's how it came across, but in no ways was the intention that the Parliament rules supersede the Constitution, because that would just be impossible. And lastly, I think that, but obviously, I did in a rush. What I was trying to get at there is that, as many people have mentioned, is that this process has been going on for a very, 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 very long time. And so I guess there's two options. We take, you know, there's the two opinions. Sorry, Speaker, but just to make the example, there's two different very strong legal opinions. The one speaks to a process that needs to start over. The other one speaks to a process that needs to be looked at in light of, you know, it can be remedied. So what we are saying is that we align with those that are saying that the process needs to start afresh. And we're saying that if the process is starting afresh, what we need to do is what, you know, various stakeholders have been doing over the years in terms of making, you know, recommendations, proposals, various submissions, but not seeing them come through when these bills are tabled. So what we're saying that our proposals are the proposal that we would like to see if the process starts afresh and a new bill is tabled. What, based on just, you know, historical research and current evidence, be put into the bill, or at least considered, or at least in the bill, or in a policy document, it's addressed how all those submissions, all those concerns were taken into account. But I think time and time again, people are making submissions, and then bills are coming out, and they're seeing, you know, nothing that reflects the submission that they made, which then translates to big question marks in terms of the nature of the consultation, and also just the value of public consultation. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you very much for the presentation. I can see that there are smiling faces around with saying something about it. Unfortunately, they won't be able to say it now. We can say that. We'll be, let me thank everybody who have presented here. Luckily today there were no hiccups, everything went very smooth. We really thank you for your contribution. And also honorable members, for especially those who are not from our committee who have joined us, that was quite progressive. We will say it elsewhere, that we had our own honorable members joining us to this very important bill. The last from myself is that we have prepared a dinner. It will take care of those that want to have chat with the presenters outside the meeting. Okay. Thank you very much. It's at the dining hall downstairs. Old Assembly Dining Hall.
Off record now. Now off record. Okay.
Good to have that as the last, our sort of final one. is it possible to, if I email you tomorrow, is it possible to get a copy of the submission that was printed today?
Whatever was submitted, I'll send
you. Yeah, because some of them were printed, but some weren't. So I'd rather just get them from you tomorrow.
Maga, not now. I'm still in a meeting, but I felt you in calling me. Let me take this. I'm still in Parliament in a meeting. Otherwise, I'll call you as soon as I finish. Okay.
Thank you, Jay.
I did sign another one.
Yeah, no, because I'm working the night shift.
Oh, okay, okay.
Yeah, because I'm going to write you an email so that I can request
the presentation.
Yeah.
Okay.
And there's also, I need clarity.
Yeah.
Where you said there is a framework internationally.
Okay.
Right? You said
yeah.
You said the MPRDA, does Section 54 of MPRDA.
Yes. Do you know what I'll do? I'll also send you the written submission because it's all in there.
Yeah, the compensation is unclear.
Yes.
In Section 54.
It basically leaves it all up to DMR, and I mean, we've tried. You write. I mean, we've got people who've written letters 4 years ago.
And then you said the framework is there internationally, and there's no reason why we can't have a framework similar to the international one.
I'm saying that we need one that's even better.
Okay.
Because of. Ask him if he's going to the book launch.
A better framework similar to the international.
Okay. Okay. Just, yeah, I hope you can see it. And then I'll just, yeah.
What's your number?
Office is 021.
021.
650.
650.
34.
34.
05.
05.
Okay. PUN? Yes.
Ndiniso?
Yeah. A. It's an A.
Oh, Ndinisa.
Yeah.
Okay, Umni.
Udlam, Amazoch.
I'll get me to the
Okay,
sure. Go see, sir.